Improve your construction projects with real-time insights direct from the site with Procore's easy-to-use platform. Learn more at Procore.com. Procore, software for the people who build the world.
It's Wednesday, the 29th of November, 2023, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. And we're here to talk about some of the news that has filtered out from the construction industry over the last fortnight or so. So I suppose the main topic or the thing which a lot of people will have been focused on, Phil, will be the autumn statement, the Chancellor's autumn statement last year. There was a lot of industry comment from that, but you wanted to pick up on something that we discussed in the last podcast.
Yeah, yes, I do, because I said, well, I'll come on to that. First of all, I think we should say a big hurrah for those Indian tunnellers.
Oh, yeah.
41 Indian tunnellers who've been trapped underground after a collapse for 17 days, and they were rescued yesterday. So that is fabulous news, which we should, it's terrible news that they've been trapped there, but fabulous news that they all came out alive.
Remarkable.
And it's just something we should say a big hurrah for.
Yeah.
So that's good. But back on track, back in this country. Yes, last week you may remember that we talked about the chief executive of the Infrastructure and Projects Authority, Nick Smallwood, telling the Treasury Select Committee that hybrid working was causing all sorts of delays to infrastructure projects around the country. And what a bad thing it is. And I think I said at the time, I thought, this is super interesting, but I'd be interested to know whether this is based on studies and there's some sort of science behind it, or whether it's just his, you know, old man gut feeling that people are working their pyjamas and swinging the lead watching Neighbours all day. Is Neighbours still on? I don't know.
No, not anymore. That's finished.
Anyway, so I've had a reply since we last spoke from the Treasury. And they said, here's some information on background. And I never quite know what that means. You can use it, but you can't attribute to someone. Anyway, basically they said, the answer to the question, is it fact or just opinion? He said, this is a view based on regular interaction with industry leaders and experts. It's a view. It's his opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I also asked him whether this would mean if working from home was so bad that, you know, it's delaying projects and pushing up costs, whether the government should ban it for public sector projects. And their reply was, value for money is always the deciding factor in all government procurement processes. In other words, no, we don't dare do that.
No, exactly, exactly.
But they also answered a question I didn't ask. I didn't ask the question, how often does Nick Smallwood go into the office?
But they answered that one, did they?
But they did say, the comments made were directly in reference to contractors within the supply chain and not government employees.
Yeah.
In other words, government employees working from home, that's fine. We can do it, but you can't.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. No, I thought that was interesting. I'm glad you followed that one up because he was fairly specific about the impact that hybrid working was having on infrastructure projects, wasn't he? He actually gave figures, something like 20%. Yeah, no, between nine months delay in the start of each project or something like that.
Yeah, no, you're right. He did. I can't actually have to go back and look at the piece. 9 to 12 month extension, that's right, of the design.
Yeah.
It's specifically the design efforts. I mean, obviously, the people actually pouring concrete aren't working from home. Not yet, at least, not until we have everything done by robots operated remotely. But no, 9 to 12 month extension of the design durations, which is a lot.
Yeah, but that's just an opinion, no facts.
Just an opinion.
Yeah, just an opinion. Oh, well.
So I thought that was worth following up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, kicking on, you mentioned the autumn statement, which was a week ago today, last Wednesday. We had, as usual, masses and masses and masses of people dropping in their sixpence worth of their thoughts and comments. But to me, the main headline I took out for the construction industry was this business of what used to be called the super deduction, is now called full expensing of capital investment, which Rishi Sunak introduced when he was Chancellor to encourage companies to invest in plant, factories, machinery, and so on. And they would be able to write it all off, the whole expenditure against their tax rather than just part of it. And this was introduced on a temporary basis, and then he extended it a bit. And last week, Jeremy Hunt, Chancellor, said, it's permanent, folks. It's not just going to be, you know, keep renewing it. It's going to say, right, this is this, what is now called full expensing, is here to stay. Except it's still not here for plant hire companies.
No, I know.
Which is kind of odd because they buy most of the plant in the construction industry.
Yeah, well, maybe there's a little bit of subterfuge here that the government isn't going to give away too much. It looks like a very generous arrangement for the industry, but they very cleverly sort of cut off any application to the main source of equipment investment, which is by the plant hirers rather than the contractors. So although they say we're doing contractors a massive favour here by giving them this tax cut, they're not really, because they still have to hire most of their equipment from the people who aren't qualified or aren't entitled to the deduction.
Correct.
If they were to extend it to the plant hire industry, of course, that would change the figures quite substantially, wouldn't it?
But you can, I think I mentioned before, I had a conversation with a tax expert at Lang O'Rourke. Those companies who buy their own, who do buy their own plant, I mean, Lang O'Rourke buys their own plant, they qualify. Yeah.
So does Select Plant gets the super deduction, does it?
It was at least a year ago when I was talking to this chap. I should have rung him back up again for a follow-up. I might do that because he was very helpful. I suppose they do. Yes, I mean, because most of Select Plants is for Lang O'Rourke. It might depend whether the final bill is paid by, it's got Select Colours on it, but if the bill is paid by Lang O'Rourke, I guess, then they're not a leasing company. And it's an internal leasing arrangement. I mean, Select, certainly their tower cranes, they do hire out to other companies, but most of their kit is hired out to Lang O'Rourke. I think that's a safe thing to say. So don't hold me to that.
Interesting. Interesting. Maybe Lang O'Rourke is an exception to the rule.
Well, there are other
there are others.
I mean, you know, Banner Plant is part of Boot. Is that right? And there are other contractors who've got plant hire divisions that they own. But on the whole, most plant hire companies are independent. And therefore don't qualify, unless I think they're sending it out with an operator, in which case they're not a hire company. They're not leasing the machine. They're providing a service.
That's right.
They're providing a lifting service or a digging service or whatever it is. The slight ray of sunshine peeking through the curtains is that the Treasury at least is now aware of the fact that construction and plant hire companies are outside the scope. And they say that they are looking at including them. We're talking to a wide range of stakeholders and plan to publish a technical consultation in due course.
So they're dangling a carrot.
I mean, let's face it, it's going to take at least a year, so it'll be some other buggers popping by the time that comes around.
Sure.
But watch the space, we'll see what happens there. You also, I think, got all the masses of comments that came in from the industry. Did anyone strike you as being particularly insightful or particularly mad with their comments?
No, not particularly. They're all saying more or less the same thing. Stuff like, a lot of them were very complimentary about the super deduction being made permanent. And there was something about the merger of R&D expenditure. There was an R&D... I'm trying to remember what the situation is. If you carry out industry R&D, you're entitled to certain tax benefits. And there has been a bit of talk in the industry. A few of these people brought it up in their comments on the autumn statement, because the Chancellor did something about merging R&D expenditure and SME schemes. And one of the problems with these R&D tax breaks is that it's often the small SMEs that are doing the research, and yet the people who qualify for the tax breaks are those who commission the research. So you'll often get a big contractor or maybe even a client actually paying for the research to be done by an SME, a specialist, who comes up with a brilliant idea, solves a problem and all the rest of it, and doesn't get any of the tax benefits. And I think one of the problems is that I can't remember exactly what the Chancellor did with this regard, but I think he's made it even more difficult for SMEs to get access to these tax breaks. So one or two people did pick that up. But apart from that, they said more or less what you'd expect them to say about, you know, planning reform and stuff like that.
Now, a lot of people with a green tint were saying, oh, it wasn't green enough and should have done more for green. You had familiar refrain about VAT should be extended to refurbishment and not just new build, which is, yeah. I think we've talked about this before, it's mad that you're incentivized to knock down a building and start again than to do it up by the tax system, which is ungreen, unsustainable. Oh, I was about to go off on a tangent about another beer in my bonnet I've got about the office.
Go on, go for it, Phil.
Is it 2030? There's some in the quite, maybe even sooner, 2027. All offices will have to, you can't let out an office unless it meets an EPC, whatever it is rating, was A or C. And therefore there are gazillions, there's masses. We read a piece about all these office starts in the City of London, particularly, but London in general, masses of office refurbishments going on. There's nothing wrong with these offices, but we're having to spend lots and lots of money. I mean, it's great for the construction industry or lots and lots of work, but it's, I think I said before, the most sustainable thing, the greenest thing, is to do nothing, not to spend lots and lots of money, you know, travelling down to the shops to buy new wires and cables and light fittings and radiators and whatever else, and knock things around and do work on a building at the cost of 30 million, 100 million quid or whatever. I dare say that'll have a payback after 40 years, but it's not exactly a sustainable thing, you know.
No.
Leave it. It's a perfectly happy office building. Get on with it.
There was one other, going back to the autumn statement, there was one other comment which you drew my attention to, so you'll know what it is. The Chancellor's comments about late payment. He said that one of the key challenges facing small businesses is the cash flow implications of late payment, which hold them back from investing and innovating. And that came around the same time as we had an email from, I think, probably the legal representatives of a small contractor.
No, it's from the MD. The MD himself sent it.
It was from the MD himself, was it?
Yep.
The owner,
managing director.
I mean, can we name the company? Yeah, of course we can name them because it's...
We've run the article.
The contractor is a company called Providence. I don't know exactly what sort of work they do.
Building services.
And its client was a company developer called Hexagon.
Housing Association,
that's correct. And this was all about late payment. And we got the email because Providence, the contractor, had lost their case. Now, the background to it, I mean, this is, like all these legal things, a bit of a minefield unless you're a legal expert, because it's very easy to misconstrue what people are saying. And of course, the use of legal jargon can often throw you off the scent. I mean, some words which are used in common parlance have a different meaning when uttered by lawyers. For example, the judge in this case, in his summing up, described something as being trite. And normally that's used as a derogatory term, that, you know, your argument is trite. It means that don't waste my time. But what it means in this context is it's simple and plain and self-evident.
Let's just go back. I want to, in a sentence, say what the argument's about.
Yes, of course.
Hexagon kept paying Providence late.
Yeah.
And Providence just got so ticked off at not getting money out of their client they're entitled to. Eventually said, sod you, we're out of here.
Yeah.
And Hexagon said, well, you can't do that. And that's what the legal dispute was. It's whether they had the right to walk off the job.
That's right.
For non-payment or non-impromptu payment, late payment.
Yeah.
And apparently they had no right to walk away. And
this,
basically, as far as the MD of Providence is concerned, Darren Tancred, he says this ruling from the court basically makes final payment dates completely optional.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. I mean, this is a thing. There's no doubt about it. From a moral point of view, and I should think the man in the street would agree that Hexagon was in the wrong here. There's no doubt about it. Providence hadn't done anything wrong, and yet they were constantly being paid. I mean, 20 payments. Received 20 payments beyond the final date, despite issuing 5 suspension notices and specified default notices. And yeah, Mr. Tancred says Providence continued to endure poor payment practices from the employer, which in turn impacted the supply chain. It wasn't just the contractor that suffered. I mean, it was his suppliers, his specialists and his material suppliers, you know, all the way down the supply chain. And everybody knows that late payment is a perennial problem in the industry. It causes a lot of waste. It increases costs. It's a scourge of the industry. It has been for, donkey's years. But no, Hexagon had done nothing wrong under the contract, under the terms of the contract. And it all seems to, you know, this is where you can very easily get very frustrated with the legal system, because it all hinged on the interpretation of specific words within specific clauses of the contract. The judge, for example, I mean, the judge did not agree with Providence's overemphasis, I'm quoting now, Providence's overemphasis of the words "for any reason" in clause 894, but instead looked at those words in the context of the preceding clause 893 and the words "does not give". So, you know, you might consider that those words, those phrases, are in legal terms trite, they're self-evident, but no, they are open to interpretation. Basically, what happened, it seems to me, and this is my interpretation as a complete layman, is that Hexagon basically pushed it to the wire every single time. They didn't pay by the final payment date. They waited for Providence to issue a default notice to them, and then they waited until the very last minute before they settled the bill. And then they just started doing the same thing over and over again. Now, after a while, as you say, the contractor got completely pissed off with this and said, "No, I'm not having this. This is giving me a headache. I'm out." But I think the legal reason why they were unable to do this legally is that they had to do something proactive under the, I think it was clause 893. They had to actually say to Hexagon, you know, "We're giving you notice to quit." And only after they'd done that could they actually quit when there was a repeat of the default. So if they hadn't done it the previous time, if they hadn't given notice the previous time it happened, they weren't entitled to do it the next time it happened. And of course they didn't. The judge, in fact, I think it was the legal team for Hexagon, talked about trigger-happy contractors. They basically said, they hadn't given notice previously. So when it happened, all of a sudden they threw their toys out of the pram and said, you know, "We're giving you notice that we're going to quit." And they described that as trigger happy.
I've got the quote in front of me. They said, "It's a salient reminder to trigger happy contractors that jumping the gun during the termination process will have significant consequences."
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think is a pretty shitty thing to say, because basically Providence, it seems to me, had held fire by not issuing that notice to quit the previous time it happened. They waited until it had happened for the umpteenth time and then said, "We're giving you notice to quit, and we're quitting this time. We mean it." And that was construed as being trigger happy. I mean, the lawyer for Hexagon said that, you know, they already had the right to suspend work, to charge interest on the debt, or adjudicate to recover the debt. And they didn't do that. Instead, they said, "We're going to leave the job. We're going to walk off site." And that was considered to be a repudiatory breach of the contract. And I think any normal person would agree with Mr. Tancred when he says that this is, this basically gives carte blanche to clients to continue with payment abuse, to ignore payment deadlines and just pay when they feel like it. or when they actually have no more, you know, rope, they're at the end of their tether and they have to pay. So, it's really appalling misuse of the contract, I think.
What's worse is that Providence have not been given leave to appeal.
No, that's right, yeah. They can't appeal it. And that, I mean, I don't know on what grounds. I haven't read the judge's comments on that. But I think the thing which seems so unjust is that the judge, I'm sure, is a very wise man. He is I can't remember the judge's name, but I'm sure he's very wise and he knows his onions.
Not necessarily.
But he has basically looked at it and said, from a purely legal point of view, which is, of course, what lawyers should do, no, these clauses, 894 and 893, and all the sub-clauses therein, if you boil them down and analyze them and weigh them up and consider them in context, this is what it means, that basically Providence doesn't have a leg to stand on legally. And of course, he doesn't bother himself with the moral niceties of it and the fact that everybody would be howling with indignation at his decision. He has to make that decision based on the facts. But I'd like to think that somebody will challenge that. I don't know how you can challenge a decision like that. Maybe you need another case and another judge to make a decision on the same on basically the same circumstances and overrule this. But to me, it seemed entirely wrong.
Yes, I'm with you on that one.
I think a lot of subcontractors would be with us as well, Phil. You know, a lot of contractors, main contractors, who find themselves in the same position. I mean, it just isn't. Yeah, you know, I pay my utility bills. Well, actually, I pay them by. I used to. In the olden days, I used to pay my utility bills at the last minute because I thought, why give British Telecom or Southeast Electricity or whoever it was my money to earn interest for them when I could earn interest on it until I need to pay them? So
well,
I'm waiting
for
the bill.
Well, for the past 10 years, so I'm interrupting, I apologise, but for the past 10 years, that hasn't mattered because there's been no interest that you're losing out on, but now it matters. You are losing
yes,
out
that's
interest
true.
If you pay your
yeah, money. That's a good point. But also, I'm paying by direct debit now and I think Octopus Energy has hundreds of pounds of mine for energy that I haven't yet used.
Oh, that's so common. Yes, they all do that.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So that's the way it works these days. But anyway, it's I can understand why, you know, you don't want to pay until you have to pay. But when there is a specified final date for payment, that's when you're supposed to pay. That's your red bill. Not, I'm not going to pay that until you're screaming blue murder at me and threatening me with the lawyers, which is basically what Hexagon did. And, yeah. Of course, Providence wasn't trigger happy. They could have invoked that notice and invoked the lawyers, you know, threatened them with the lawyers. But the fact that they didn't and they waited until it happened for the umpteenth time that they actually pulled the plug.
You said 20 times. Is that an accurate number, or is that just a sort of
that's a number? Yeah, that's a number that Mr. Tancred says. Yeah, he says that it was.
Yeah. No, it's in the piece I reported. I know you've got the full judgment as well, but yes. I just had the summary piece from information. Yeah, 20 payments beyond the final day of payment, which is that's not
that's payment abuse.
That's not an accident. That's a strategy.
No, that's deliberate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they got away with it and laughing all the way to the bank, and I think it's disgraceful.
Well, I think the construction industry should gang up on Hexagon and get their own back in some clever, dirty way.
Yeah. It's ironic, isn't it? Because this has always been the problem, and there have been so many attempts to try and rectify this, and you know, project bank accounts, and well, people are still talking about project bank accounts. In fact, it's fairly current even now, isn't it? But going back 20 years or so, or even more than that, I mean, the Construction Act, which of course is the relevant law here. I can't remember what the full title of the Housing Grants and Construction Act 1996, I think it was. That was a big milestone, really, legally, because that was introduced to try and tackle issues like this, and it introduced things like statutory adjudication.
Was that after Latham? Was that the Latham Act? Is that
it? Was yes. It was called it's often called the Latham Act. And that's the law that applies now, and it did usher in a lot of changes, and it had it has been generally speaking beneficial, but it hasn't eradicated late payment and payment abuse, and in fact that all came back with a vengeance after the financial crash of global financial crash of 2008, because it was all things were all nice and hunky-dory for several years after the Act came in, right up until the financial crash, and everything turned to shit and people started picking on each other again, and it was no longer
nicey.
Yeah, no, exactly. Everybody reverted to type, and it's really been like that still. I mean, not as bad as it used to be, but I think it's still endemic throughout the industry. Well, another bit of this is a topic. Well, we're talking about Grenfell Tower here, aren't we? We're talking about the misbehaviour amongst construction professionals, but this is specifically very different issue.
The story I ran this week was that the contract to look after and monitor, keep an eye on, keep it standing up, the remaining structure of the Grenfell Tower in West London, the contract's up for renewal. The current contractor, their three-year term ends in March, April next year. And so they've published the contract notice, I beg your pardon, July next year. Deconstruction is the current contractor. And their three-year contract expires next year. And this contract is going to be worth, according to contract notice, £20 million for 3 years. So that's, roughly speaking, £7 million a year is being spent on
keeping
up standing what is essentially today a monument, to corporate greed, corruption, all sorts of horrible things.
Well, a monument to the victims of corporate greed and corruption, I think.
I beg your pardon, that's a much better way of putting it. The 72 people who died in that fire in 2017. So the fire 6.5 years ago, the structure's still standing. Yes, the inquiry is still going on. That'll come out next summer, the final report from Martin Moorblick. Is that his name?
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
Moorblick. His final report comes out next summer. But it's been 2.5 years since structural engineers told the government that there is unanimous agreement among all technical experts and engineers involved in the Grenfell project post the fire, that the tower should not be propped for the medium to long term and needs to be deconstructed at the earliest possible opportunity. In May 2021, they said that this should happen no later than May 2022, should start taking it down.
Mm.
This is advice is based on protecting the safety of those working in and living around the tower. Ministry got a second opinion from Jacobs. Jacobs agreed with the first set of consultants who are Atkins. So this is two of the top firms, consulting engineers around.
They're
all saying, look, it needs to come down. It's not safe. I mean, we have propped it up to make it sort of temporarily safe, but this is not a long-term, it's not sustainable, to use that word again. The problem is, it's such a sensitive subject that no politician wants to be the bastard who says, okay, bring it down. And whatever else people might say about Michael Gove, and apparently Nadine Dorries thinks he's Beelzebub, there is an element of touchy feelingness about him. He is sufficiently sensitive to understand that it's almost analogous to raising the Titanic or the Kursk submarine that sank. I mean, for many people, it's hallowed because of the horror that went on there. And it takes engineers basically to be rational and say, of course it was an awful thing, but we cannot just keep paying £7 million a year to monitor and prop and keep standing and rewrap it every year. This uninhabited tomb, basically. We need to bring it down. And now we can put up a fantastic memorial in its place, which is structurally sound and doesn't need £7 million a year maintenance. I mean, let's get in Anthony Gormley or someone fantastic like that to do something fabulous. Preferably not the Garden Bridge man, you know, a proper sculptor. And I'm kind of on the side of the engineers. Okay, you know.
Well, I'm definitely on the side of the engineers. I mean, I was rather surprised to find that there was so much, apparently, so much public feeling that wanted it left there as a memorial, because I hadn't realised that. I mean, I assumed, maybe I hadn't thought it through, but I'd assumed that it was left there because it might still be a source of evidence in the inquiry. But we're past that. We know what happened.
And 6.5 years? No.
Yeah, so we know what happened. So, but, I mean, who is there an organisation that is actually saying we need to preserve it? Is anybody actually saying we need to leave this building standing?
I don't know. I mean, one of the main organisations representing the survivors and the bereaved relatives is Grenfell United. And I actually don't know whether they have said it needs to be preserved forever, but certainly they are. And there are all sorts of stakeholders who are being consulted and kept very much at the forefront of any decision that goes on. And I've just had a quick look at, and I need to look at it properly, see whether they say what their view of the future of the tower is. Mostly what they're talking about, their main call, I guess, is for those parties who are culpable to face the full force of the law.
Yes.
You know, the corruption's been exposed. Now we need to punish it, basically.
Yeah. I suppose that while the inquiry is going on, you know, the wreckage of that tower block is standing there as a reminder, just in case anybody takes their sort of eye off the ball or forgets. But I think certainly I can kind of understand people saying that it should be standing until we've actually completed, you know, Sir Martin Moorbick has completed his inquiry and people have face the music, as it were. But, you know, if it's a dangerous structure that needs to be propped up, I mean, heaven forbid that it should actually collapse and cause even more damage and injury.
I think we should accept that it's not dangerous because we are spending £7 million
a year. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe it's because people feel that because the inquiry hasn't finished next year. I don't know. When do we know when it's going to be published next year?
Middle of the year. The latest guidance from the committee.
That maybe when that has happened, and presumably there will be legal action against those found to be at fault.
Oh, but that can still take ages. I mean, we've seen many analogous, but not the same cases of health and safety executive investigations, where they might do their report. And even after the report's on someone's desk, it can still be years before the Crown Prosecution Service says, OK, now we're going to move forward. I don't think we're going to see the beginning of a court case for... I was surprised if it was at least 2 years away, frankly.
Yeah. So given that... I don't think, you know, when do you decide to bring the tower down? Because it's got to come down sooner or later. I would say a decent compromise would be after publication of the official inquiry. You know, everybody knows what happened. We've identified the people who were involved. We can now sort of draw a line underneath that and take the building down. I mean, demolishing the remains of Grenfell Tower is... I don't think it's disrespectful to the people who, you know, the victims and their survivors. I think it has to be done because it is a dangerous structure and it's serving no useful purpose. Because if you want a memorial, build one on the site, yeah, a garden or a...
Something useful and lasting.
Something useful and lasting, yeah, exactly. And I think it's serving no useful purpose.
Well, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment. Forgive me if this is a very bad analogy, but I think there are some parallels. Okay, only, in inverted commas, 72 people died in the Grenfell Tower fire. But they died as a result of some really quite horrible things that went on. There are former Nazi concentration camps around Eastern Europe, in Germany and in Poland, in Hungary, I believe, which are open as tourist attractions today. Now, not tourist attractions as in fun fairs and park rides. Everyone goes there and goes, "Wee, what a lovely time you're having at the concentration camp." but as historical, you know, more like a museum.
Yes, yes, yes.
They still draw lots of people, and they exist so that, not so that, in the hope that it will never happen again, as a memorial to history, so I think this happened, here's the proof that it happened, it must never happen again. And perhaps keeping Grenfell Tower at the cost of £7 million a year, rewrapping it every year in its fabric, standing there in the middle of West London, it stands as a sort of permanent reminder, this must never happen again. And if it became just, you know, another nice new shiny block of flats like the World Trade Center became, they knocked that down, rebuilt it. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a much closer analogy, maybe. But I can see that the argument for saying it must never come down. I don't hold that view. I'm more of the, let's go with the World Trade Center analogy. We can do better. Let's do better.
Yeah, I take your point, and it's... But the Holocaust was quite different from Grenfell Tower.
Yes, of course it was.
It was intentional. It wasn't, well, I mean, you can argue whether it was intentional or a matter of neglect, which obviously it was neglect and greed at Grenfell Tower. But also it was a tragedy on a somewhat smaller scale, although we shouldn't minimize it or talk it down. For the UK, it's had lasting impact. For the construction industry, it's had lasting impact, and lessons will be learned. No, I don't think there's any case to preserve it as a monument. I think knock it down and erect a new monument.
But everything has happened so slowly since Grenfell. This inquiry has taken forever. Deciding what to do with the tower itself is taking forever. All the recladding of the dangerous cladding, the replacement of that seems to be taking forever. I mean, that's still going on. And we reported this morning that the new building safety regulator, this office within the health and safety executive, which is, I mean, we don't really need it. Why did I say the health and safety executive does this job? But anyway, in order to make it look like we're making an effort and doing the right thing, we've got this new, this room in the HSE, which has got its own name, called the Building Safety Regulator. It came into existence in April this year, 7 months ago. And today it's just published its 27-page document, its strategic plan. Now, I would have thought if you've got a new body that comes into being in April 2023, it should have its strategic plan from day one, because we knew it was coming into being.
Yes.
We spent 6 years talking about it coming into being. Why is it taking so...
Yeah, well, it came into being as a direct result of
Yes,
Grenfell
it's all part,
Tower,
part
it?
Of, and it goes back the Judith Hackett report and
Judith Hackett's
building regs and fire safety regs and so on. And we had the Building Safety Act. It's actually the Building Safety Act which gives it its powers, which created the Building Safety Regulator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, as I say, it's really just basically an arm, an office within the health and safety executive. It's even the same HSE bod who is the head of the building safety regulator.
Yeah.
And it's strategic plan. Okay, I'm going to say it's going to improve the safety and standard of all buildings. It's going to make sure residents of higher risk buildings are safe and help restore trust in the built environment sector. Well, who could argue with that? Fabulous. I'm not terribly excited. It was just regulating planning and design. We had regulations before. We had standards before. We had regulations. We had regulators before. We had building control before. We had planning control. All the things we had before. I think there's still going to be bad actors who'll find a way around it.
Yeah, there always are. I mean, we were talking about late payment just now. You know, that hasn't gone away, despite God knows how much effort, you know, to find a way around it. But it's a tricky one. I hadn't fully appreciated the strength of community feeling about Grenfell Tower, and I always assumed it was only standing because the authorities needed it to be standing, just in case they needed to go in there and find more evidence. I was rather surprised to find out that isn't the case.
That's not my understanding. I mean, if I'm wrong, people, podcast out the Construction Index. But I think it's the people without a voice now have, or you know, are being allowed a voice when it comes to Grenfell Tower, and they may not feel it, but I think they could easily have, the authorities could easily have come in you know, a year after the fire or less, and just knocked it down, say it's coming down. But it's not a police issue. It's a political issue. I'm sure of it.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Should we move on to our final topic, Phil? Which is this is another one of the bees in your bonnet, Phil. You must have a veritable hive. Go on, fire away. What are we talking about?
Right. Well, the government. Why this has got no more publicity, I do not know. The government has lent some money to those poor, impoverished souls, Goldman Sachs and Persimmon.
I know.
More specifically, they've actually lent it to a building company called Top Hat. Top Hat are...
Are they a building company?
They're a manufacturing
company.
They manufacture volumetric houses. And the government's desperate to make this industry work. But we've seen Legal & General quit that sector last year, and or this year, wasn't it earlier this year? And Ilka Homes go bust this year. Ilka Homes, when it went bust owing Homes England £60 million plus interest. £68 million Homes England lost, having lent money to Ilka Homes. And so what have they done, Homes England? Well, they've now lent £15 million. Okay, not quite as much as they lent to Ilka, but they've lent £15 million to Top Hat. And Top Hat is owned by, as I said, Goldman Sachs, Persimmon, and is it Aviva, the insurance company, I think? So hugely rich people.
Yeah.
Lent them this money in the hope that they won't go bust as well. And I think, okay, well, maybe it's good business for the government to lend money to successful businesses and make a profit and make money for the taxpayer on that. But I don't think the government should be running down to Ladbrokes to put, you know, 10 bob on Shifty Boy on the 330. And nor should it be taking punts on startup businesses that have not yet to make a profit and are quite upfront about the fact they're not going to make a profit for another 3 years. There should be questions asked about this, and everyone's saying, no, it's fine. We like volumetric building. We like modern methods of construction. We should support it with government money. We should back it. I mean, and this is not giving them, you know, tax breaks or incentives to move to, you know, one city rather than another, or move to a enterprise zone or a freeport. This is specifically saying, hello, Goldman Sachs, here's 15 million quid of Johnny taxpayer you can have.
Yeah.
And as I say, they got their fingers burnt last time and they're at it again. I actually emailed Homes England when I got this and I said, I'm a bit surprised by this. Wouldn't have thought Goldman Sachs were short of a bob or two, nor Persimmon, since they can afford to give their chief executive £70 million bonuses for just doing his job. Why doesn't the Persimmon chief executive lend it 50, you know, lend 15 million from his pocket money to Top Hat? I didn't actually say that in those terms. I said to Homes England, is this loan to Top Hat on the same terms as the money you lent to Ilka Homes and never got back? Or have you learnt something from that and got some sort of protection in place?
And they said?
They said, okay, thank you for your email. When do you need an answer by? And I replied, as soon as you can, please. 8 o'clock tomorrow morning would be good. That was a week ago. Never heard back. So I emailed them yesterday and said, I haven't heard, I have no answer to this query yet. I haven't heard back. Still no answer. So that says to me that they don't have anything to say in their defence, basically. They're not saying, oh, we're really clever, we've learned and we've done this.
They've just done the same thing again.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
They've just repeated.
They've just done the same thing again. That's all I can assume from the lack of an answer to my question.
I mean, but you know, successive governments have sort of pinned their colours to the whole sort of modern methods of construction thing. It's this sort of panacea that, you know, will solve the housing crisis, reduce construction costs, and benefit the economy more widely. And of course, some volumetric offsite manufacturing is probably the most widespread and most favoured modern method of construction. Well, there's nothing particularly modern about it in concept. So I think that for years it's been the official line that we need to do whatever we can to stimulate the market for modern methods of construction. But unfortunately, the market isn't playing ball. The market doesn't seem to like it as much as the experts in the industry do themselves. We've talked about this before, haven't we? That if you're going to build something in a factory, you need to have
the throughput.
Exactly. You need to do it at volume.
Someone will win at this game, I have no doubt. Ever since Egan came along, the construction industry has always, or the MMC brigade have always liked to use the analogy of the automotive sector. We make cars in a factory. Why shouldn't we make houses in a factory? It's the way to do it. Much better. Egan himself was a Jaguar boss, which is why they brought him in. And yet, if we look at every time, the history of British industry, I can think of many examples when the government has felt moved to step in and lend money and pump money into it, including the automotive industry, and it hasn't saved it. It's thrown good money after bad. Failed with Rover, with Jaguar, British Leyland. I cannot think off the top of my head of an example of British government stepping in to prop up an industry which then I'm going, oh, thank you, now we're brilliant, now we can be a great industry. Can you?
No, I can't. No, not off the top of my head. I mean, there are jobs at stake, and that always... you know, that always has an effect. You have to save jobs. Probably the only good reason for doing that, to keep people working. But no, I can't think of an industry which has turned around as a result of the government throwing money at it.
Well, what's going to happen if the construction industry follows the automotive industry, like many people say it should? We're going to have the construction version of Nissan or Toyota or General Motors getting huge government incentives to set up their factories in the UK, because we decided the British manufacturers can't do it effectively, can't make it work. And that would probably be even more expensive
in the long
run
to the taxpayer
than lending money and never getting it back to British companies, that are, you know, British startups. So maybe heads we lose and tails we lose.
Yes, possibly. I mean, Top Hat itself, it has... Obviously, it has built or made some homes, hasn't it? And I can think of one development, which I think is somewhere Chatham. There's a development in Chatham.
It's big on in Chatham. I can't remember if that's Top Hat or
I think that's Top Hat.
Too, I've got to be honest.
Yeah, there's one in Chatham where they built a development of homes. I can't think of any others.
There are a few odds and sods. You know, three or four here, five there. I think there's one in Bristol have got a couple, I think maybe Brighton. Yes, I'm not as up to speed with where they've all gone up as they should, but there's a bunch. Okay. I mean, they've made a few hundred of these in their existing factory in Corby, but they haven't made what's the capacity of the Corby factory?
It's something
800 units a year. I've got it here. They're not making 800 units a year, but they've got this new robotized factory coming on stream in Corby next year with capacity for 4,000 units a year.
All they need is some customers.
My, yeah. I mean, 4,000 is diddly squat compared to the 300,000 that houses we're meant to be building each year to, you know, for our rapidly expanding population.
Should they be selling these houses to the, you know, the big six house building firms?
Well, that's why Persimmon are involved, isn't it?
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, they'll be doing it, yeah. But I mean, that's the only market I can think of where it would work, because we know that there's demand there. Whether or not there's, you know, as I said earlier, the market fluctuates so wildly. If they've got a factory capable of producing 4,000 homes a year and nobody wants any, I can't see how it would work. I mean, they can't store them very easily. They can store some, but they couldn't store a couple of years' worth. I mean, house building stopped dead, didn't it, in the financial crash? It just simply stopped.
Yes, you mean the most recent
one? Yeah, the most recent one, yeah. And in the one in 2008.
The
COVID one.
Trust crash.
The trust crash.
It carried on. It's the trust crash interest rates going up. I mean, COVID sort of, you know, put the stops to a lot of things. But the housing market came back again after that. It's just that when interest rates went up to whatever they went up, did they go up to 10% or whatever? No, it's inflation. Yeah. All that said, I do wish Top Hat good luck because they've got 15 million of our money.
Yes, exactly.
So good luck, Top Hat.
I've got an and finally, Phil.
Oh, excellent. What is it?
I got a press release last week, I think it was. Let me see if I can find it. From Mace. You probably got it as well. The headline is, almost 75% of businesses put carbon reduction ahead of profit in the last year, according to new Mace polling.
I saw that. It was another one of these bogus surveys.
Did you run a story on it? I don't think you did.
Go on. No. I didn't. You think there's something in it?
This is why I think it's strange. Four bullet points here. Mace has released the findings from an independent poll of more than 3,000 senior business leaders from around the world, not just in the UK. From across the UK and USA, 82% of businesses now have a carbon reduction strategy for their property/infrastructure portfolios, up from 61% in 2022. Now, that doesn't surprise me.
That's just a statement. Nothing else, it's saying we like carbon or we hate carbon.
Yeah, exactly. 54% of businesses believe that between 5 and 20% of revenue should be reinvested into tackling climate change. However, 90% of Mace's clients believe the sector's progress on decarbonisation has stalled. Now, it's all very much on message, you know, net zero. You know, the drive to net zero by, is it still 20?
Sorry, 90%. Did you just say 90% of Mace's clients think Mace are not doing enough?
That is one interpretation. Yeah, they say they believe the sector's progress on decarbonisation has stalled. Now, the thing is...
That doesn't sound very good for Mace, does it?
What they're saying is, I'm trying to find the specific thing. Yeah. The report outlines how businesses around the world are continuing to take climate change seriously, of course. Further, some 74% of business leaders said that they have actively put carbon reduction ahead of profit in the last 12 months. To me, that's either nonsense or we should all be scared, because that's not their job. I mean, their job is to make a profit. Their job is to run a successful business.
To keep people employed. To pay taxes.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they can't save the planet if they don't do that. That's their basic core function. They have to run a business that makes a profit. Otherwise, they're not in business and they can't save the planet. So what are they talking about? If three quarters of business leaders around the world are taking their eye off the ball, basically, and neglecting their core function, those businesses are in trouble, I reckon.
See, so many businesses think profit's a dirty word because they see the flak that Jeff Fairbairn at Persimmon making huge amounts of profit. They think, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be labelled a bastard. I want to be a good guy. Therefore, I'm going to pretend that profits don't matter. I'm going to say that safety is our number one priority or whatever. If safety is your number one priority, don't get out of bed.
Not quite.
Take some exercise, go down to the gym for a bit, stay healthy and have some food, but then go back to bed.
Yeah.
Don't go to work. It's dangerous.
Exactly. And I think that if this is the result of Mace's research, what you've got there is 74% of business leaders are lying through their teeth. They're saying that they're putting net zero or carbon reduction before profit because they're conscious of the audience listening to them, you know, the people who are wringing their hands about climate change.
They're
and
woke.
Yeah, well, yeah, you could say that. I mean, woke is shorthand, but it's laden with all sorts of meaning. They're basically thinking, oh, we need to look good because we'll get a lot of flack if we say, no, we're more interested in profit than saving the planet, because that sounds bad.
But let's just go back to what that survey said for one moment. Are they saying that 74% of CEOs always put the planet net zero before profit, or are they saying they have on at least one occasion done that? I.e., they once decided to do something which costs them money because it was the right thing to do. But normally they don't.
Well, the press release doesn't say that. Is there a link to the actual report?
What was the actual word in the
press release?
The actual wording was... They have done it or they do it?
They said that they have actively put carbon reduction ahead of profit in the last 12 months. Representing...
Right. So not...
Yeah,
that could mean that they did it once. Sometime in the last year, I have put it. Okay, so 26% have never done anything virtuous just for the sake of being virtuous.
Correct. Yes.
Bastards. I think that's... Okay, they're the bastards. let's flip this one around.
Yeah, I don't know. It's open to interpretation. As you say, they have actively put carbon reduction ahead of profit on one occasion, maybe when they'd had a bit too much to drink, and or when their kids are giving them a hard time, or whatever. But at a fractious shareholders meeting. No, they wouldn't have done it at a shareholders meeting.
But to be honest, let's be frank, even when businesses do put green stuff before profit, they're doing it for profit. Companies
ultimately
aren't planting trees because they love planting trees. They're planting trees because they are required to win the contract.
Yes.
They have to demonstrate this stuff, particularly on public sector contracts. They have to outgreen their competitors to make a profit.
Yeah.
So while it's not in itself directly money-making, it's part of being in business today.
It's looking
good. You can't really separate the two.
Yeah, for some people, it's merely ticking a box. When you bid for a contract now, people want to see what your sustainability criteria are. They want to know that you're... what your net zero targets are, that kind of thing. And these all count. The client, I suppose, is driving this by saying we will only employ people who, are going to save the planet for us.
I wonder how the contractors bidding for work for the new offshore drilling that's going to be going on will be demonstrating their sustainability credentials.
I don't know. Who's hosting the COP28? Is it Qatar this year?
It's UAE. UAE. I don't know if it's Dubai or Abu Dhabi.
Well, they've got no qualms, have they? I mean, they use it as an opportunity to...
We have to use recycled drill bits.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So I take that with a very large pinch of salt, actually. I think if those 74% business leaders said that they had more than half an eye on, to use your phrase, a woke audience...
No, I don't like that phrase either. I was using it in...
in an ironic way.
Right. David, I need to go get some lunch, I think. It's nearly that time of day, isn't it?
Getting on that way,
It is. We've been chatting far too long.
Yeah.
So, once again, for those who've been listening, thank you. We're still doing this once a fortnight, meeting up. If you want us to keep going, tell us, let us know.
Yeah.
But for another episode, another month.
Yes.
It'll be December next time. That's it. In fact, next reconstruction, I'm guessing, David, will probably be our last.
It is the last
year,
one of the year. Yeah, one pod till Christmas. Yeah.
Well, but for now, thank you very much. But it's goodbye for me, and it's
goodbye from me.
It is indeed. Cheerio.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.